Hi, I'm Jennifer Ackerman Haywood, and you're listening to the Craft Sanity Podcast, an interview show about art, craft, and creativity. This episode of Craft Sanity is sponsored by Jennifer Forrest. Check out confidentcrafts.com to learn about her hand-felted wool tops, and jennifer-forrest.com to learn about her book, Jane Austen Sewing Box. This episode is also sponsored by wishstudio.com. See how you can learn new skills or teach others at this online art studio. No matter where you live, you can be part of Mindy's online virtual studio space. Check it out at wishstudio.com. And Liberty Worth, a returning sponsor, is also supporting this episode of Craft Sanity. You can find out how she draws inspiration from her life to create skirts, baby slings, and hand-stamped charms at libertyworth.com. And check out the shop at libertyworth.etsy.com. Okay, so let's get to it, folks. It's time to craft sanity. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 116 of the Craft Sanity Podcast. I am really excited to bring you this episode of the show because, well, for one, I'm interviewing a local person, and secondly, Beth Ann Williams just so happens to be one of the most inspiring people that I have ever met. I just continue to be impressed by the way that she continues to not only achieve at a high level herself as a fiber artist, but she has inspired so many people around her to do the same. She's done all this while having to contend with a ridiculous amount of health issues, and she's had to deal with these health issues for most of her life. Here in West Michigan, Beth Ann Williams is known as being a fantastic fiber artist, and her reputation definitely is a national one. She taught, until fairly recently, she taught on the national circuit. She's 44, at least she was when we recorded this episode in April. So we recorded a couple months ago, and I wrote a story about her in my column for the Grand Rapids Press. And she has two daughters, she's married, and she is a creativity director for Lakeshore Sewing here in West Michigan, which is a fantastic sewing store. First time I interviewed Beth Ann was back 10 years ago when her first book came out. And it was a Celtic quilting book. And we're going to talk a little bit about her books as well. And I will have links to her website and the workshop she's going to be teaching on craftsanity.com. I'll have some links so you can check all that out. And so settle in with a project and just prepare to be inspired. And I hope when the final music plays, I hope by that time you've had a chance to briefly reflect on your own life and maybe some of the roadblocks that are standing in your way. And something tells me that after you hear from Beth Ann, you're going to be even more determined to figure out a way to get around those roadblocks, whatever they may be. Yeah, because she is, like I said, a powerhouse of inspiration. So I don't want to oversell this thing, but I really think you're going to enjoy it. And we're going to start this interview with kind of cut into her talking about just the history of quilting in her family.
I'm at least a fourth generation quilt maker on multiple sides of my family. And I'm sure it goes back a lot further than that, but I actually have quilts from that document each of those generations, which is really cool.
Wow.
When I was growing up, didn't think anything of it. It was just kind of normal. And my family is very, very creative. Almost everybody in my extended family is either a visual artist or a musician or a writer or is in television production or somehow involved in the arts, either professionally or very much as a hobbyist isn't a strong enough word, you know, for their own joy of it.
Right.
And so it was always kind of there in the background. Nobody really talked about it all that much. It was just the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up always making things, and it was just a compulsion to make things. And my parents were really good about encouraging, always very, very encouraging. And my mother was a writer, and she did a wonderful job, I think, of showing how to balance the whole home and family and writing thing, because that's an art making to extrapolate to me, because she was a wonderful mother, and she gave us the time that we, you know, needed and gave mm-hmm. us the attention. It was very encouraging, all that. But she also took time to write. And she needed to do that for her own sanity at times. She needed to take time to write. Yeah. And so there were times when writing was more important than, you know, maybe finishing this task or that task. And that was such a good model to make. And I have to be real careful here, so my mother's going to listen to this, and I don't want her to think I'm telling people she had a dirty house, because she did not. She was very clean. But just the principle of understanding that you make time for that in your life. And it's okay to make time for that, even if you have a house to take care of and meals to prepare and kids to take care of, that it's also important that you do that writing for yourself.
Right.
And that really helped me when I became a mother. Also to have that model to go back, because so many young moms especially don't realize that it's not only okay to do that, that you need to do that.
Oh, I think
to
it's
have your
necessary.
Own identity and preserve that, and not just, I mean, I love being a mom and I love my children. It's the most important thing in my life, but that's not the only thing that defines me. And I think that, you know, as women, we really need to remember that.
You
know, celebrate the whole person kind of thing. So that was a really important thing, watching her and watching the people around me. Always loved to make things, loved to do things with my hands. I learned to quilt in the 70s. And that was with my grandmother. And so, you know, the tracing around things, cutting out with scissors, hand stitching, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That I am very glad that I don't do now. It's going to take so long.
Yeah, it just takes
forever. I remember making doll clothes. And I didn't do a lot with quilting for a long time. It wasn't until after I did draw all the way growing up. When we were evacuated out of Africa the first time, my parents were missionaries, and we were evacuated out of Africa twice. And first time we got out with the clothes on our backs and what we could carry. And that's all we had. And it was an emergency situation of women and children out first. My father had to stay behind, and we thought he was at the State Department called and said, you know, the last we heard from your husband talking to my mother is that he was headed towards your home, and we heard shots, and nobody's heard from him since.
Oh my goodness.
So we didn't know if he was dead or alive.
How old were you at that point?
13.
Oh, geez.
So, but where I was going with that is that I had one change of clothes, but I had my sketchbooks and I had my colored pencils.
And so you were going to be okay.
So, you know, I was, you know, I had, you know, we took the photographs out of the albums, you know, we had what was important, you know, paring down to the essentials. But even in that kind of environment, the art making was an important grounding kind of thing and a way to process. And for me, making things has always been a way to process emotions, to show love, to make somebody something was always a way to show love. And it wasn't just a matter of not having a lot of money, although that there's been times when that was definitely a factor for, you know, it's cheaper to make gifts.
Absolutely.
But it's the time, and even when you get to the point where it would be a whole lot, it's not about keeping warm to make a quilt for somebody. It's not about keeping warm, because if it was about keeping warm, you could go buy a blanket.
Right,
you know?
you'd be warm instantly.
And you could buy a blanket for less than it would cost you to buy the fabric for a quilt.
Right.
You know, but it's about showing love. And it's about, you know, expressing yourself. It's about creating something that's beautiful. That whole, there's a quote, and I'm going to mangle it. And I'm sorry, I don't know who's the one who originally said it. But talking about pioneer women who helped, you know, open up the West to development in the early stages of the United States. They made quilts as fast as they could to keep their families warm and as beautiful as they could to feed their souls or keep themselves from crying. Or, you know, there's different, I've heard it different ways. But I think that that's so universal, and it's true today, that so many of us, and I don't want to say just women, women and men, turn to the arts, whether you want to call it craft, you want to call it arts, and pour their hearts and souls in it as a way to deal with what's happening around them, to create an area of calmness.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes with my students, I find that some of them need something that's very, very structured so that they can just sit down and let their mind sort of drift and do it by rote almost. And it creates a very soothing, calming thing, and it grounds them and it gives them peace and space and it calms what's inside. And others come to it and they need a challenge. They need a creative challenge. They need to be brought out of their humdrum, you know, regular life and need to be excited and about what they're doing. And others come because they need to have a voice and they don't feel like they have a voice in their everyday life or not as much as they, or don't know how to use the voice that they have. A lot of it, sometimes it's confidence. And so that could be an avenue for them. And for me, it has always been a little bit of everything. I didn't go back to quilting and then other art making seriously until after I had my children. I was planning on going back to Africa as a linguist. My husband and I planned to go back to Africa as a linguist. I had worked as a translator in Africa before we were married.
After, when you went to college, like when you, did you, what did you study in college? Just so people kind of know your background.
Yeah, I have, my degree was in communication arts with just one class short of a double major in psych.
Okay.
And then I also had a minor in Bible. So I had a little bit, and I think I'd have credits for a minor in science. So it's like, I love everything, you know?
How many years did you spend in college? Did you get that all done? And
I did. Wow. I did. And I actually went to college a year early. I went at 17. I hadn't graduated from high school yet.
Wow.
I graduated from high school after I'd spent my first year at college, at which point I was a second quarter sophomore.
Oh my God.
In college before I got my high school diploma.
Now, were you
it was really strange.
For the most part, or did you?
I had equal time growing up, equal time public school, private school, and homeschool.
Okay.
Or independent study. So, you know, a little bit of.
Well,
of
clearly,
everything.
It all worked very well for you.
It worked out, you know. Well, it helped. I have a, you know, a very obsessive kind of personality. And,
right.
You know,
when
and
you sound like you're curious
myself.
About things.
So yes.
You,
very
school
much.
It's a fun thing for you.
Yeah. So it. And it really. You know, that kind of approach to schooling, it really is dependent on the personality of the kid. It does not
absolutely.
Work well for every, you know, for everybody.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Cedarville University. It wasn't a university then, it was college. But
and where is that
know,
at?
Ohio.
Okay.
So which you is spent where time... I met my husband, yeah.
Is that where you, where did you grow up? I know you spent a lot of time in Africa.
Europe and Africa and New York and Pennsylvania. I was born in New Jersey, but my family lives in New York and Pennsylvania. I had moved 20 times by the time I was 20.
Wow.
So there is no one place.
Okay, so you're very worldly in your the way you've been raised and grown up.
I think at the last count of something like 17 different countries.
Oh, wow.
So, and some of those were very quick, you know, and some of them were years.
Wow.
But so, yeah, kind of all over the place. We had kind of a saying, home is where the suitcases are.
So, you need to make a quilt about that.
Yeah. Well, I've settled into Michigan. I consider myself from Michigan now, and I hope nobody in New York and Pennsylvania hears this because I don't want them to feel bad, but this has been our home. I've lived longer now in Michigan than I have anywhere else.
How long have you been here?
We moved here in 1990.
Did you come right to Grand Rapids?
We did.
Yeah, so you've been here since 1990.
We've been in this northeast. We've moved a couple of times, but we've been in this northeast section of Grand Rapids since then, and it's it's home and it's roots and it's wonderful and I love it.
Yeah,
so.
Isn't it funny how I thought I was going to be here 2 years max.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm going back to Metro Detroit and it's kind of like roots have grown.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm here most likely to stay.
Yeah. Isn't it funny?
It is. Yeah. You don't expect it really. Especially you probably didn't expect it since you've been moving like your whole life, moving places.
And we've lived in all kinds of beautiful places and dramatic places. I mean, we lived on the edge of the Sahara Desert in Chad most of the time when we were in Africa. And I also, you know, went to school in France in the French Alps, and which is beautiful. And in New York and Pennsylvania, we were in the Finger Lakes region of New York, which is gorgeous, and northeastern Pennsylvania, very beautiful and dramatic. And we moved to Michigan, and my first impression was it's kind of blah, you know.
Well, compared to the Sahara,
you know, it's just kind of blah. And it took me a while. Everybody would say, well, it's so beautiful up here, it's so beautiful there. And it took me a while to get on board with that. But you know what? Now some of my favorite places in the whole world are right here in Michigan. I love Sleeping Bear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just, it just really speaks to me.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
With the dunes and everything. And I love going to the lake and have taught up on Mackinac for years. And, you know, so there's different places that are really significant to me.
Yeah. But, so you came out of college with like 50,000 different majors.
I know.
you could go any direction you wanted, you know. And were you early coming out of college then? So you were pretty young when you're coming out. So like 20 years old. Or were you 21?
21.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so what did you do right after college?
Yeah. I actually finished early and then walked that June. Well, my husband and I were planning on going back. As I had said, my in between my junior and senior year, I went back to Ivory Coast and worked as a linguist.
Okay.
Okay. And after we graduated, I only had like two semesters more. We had planned on We had planned on going back to Africa and working in translation. And what I did, my big senior year project was I worked in a dictionary for English, Saramadengai, which is the Chadian language where we lived.
Okay, so you were working
and,
on...
And French. Oh, wow. So it was three languages. And then I worked in literacy, developing primers. And we were working with languages that had either never been written down or only, you know, fairly recently been written down. And it was so exciting because you're preserving something. And
the people's
response to be able to read and write in their own language. You know, many of them had gone to school and been educated in French because that was formerly a French colony.
Right.
But had never, you know, been able to read and write in their own language.
Right.
And so to be able to be a part of that was so thrilling. Yeah. And so that's what we had planned on going back and doing. And my husband had gone to seminary and you know, the Greek and Hebrew, and was probably going to be involved with the Bible translation as well. But about that time, I started having, I had three miscarriages and had very difficult time with my daughter. My oldest daughter almost died. And in all of that, and it actually had, we're kind of jumping around. I've had serious health problems, ongoing neurological things, and then heart trouble since my teenage years.
Oh, wow.
I was first diagnosed with, you know, neurological issues. I was like 13.
Really? Like, what kind of an issue? Problems. Like, what kind of an issue do you mean?
Severe migraines that looking back, they now, later on, figured that it was the beginnings of MS.
Oh, really? That young?
That young, yeah.
Wow.
And we're not sure at what point, because there's so many different things, because then I was 17, I was diagnosed with heart problems, and I've been on heart medication since I was 17. I had a series of heart attacks, not blockages, but I have a valve that will need to be replaced. And so I'm on stuff to control that. And we were also exposed to a lot of diseases in Africa and a lot of immunizations. And so it's unclear
as to what caused that.
It was probably a little bit of a whole lot of different factors. And then the hormonal changes with puberty and then the hormonal changes with the pregnancies and the miscarriages and whatnot really put me into a spiral that I ended up with this whole long list. It's too long to describe, but basically almost every organ or system, there's a problem.
Oh, wow.
And it became apparent that we could not go live in a third world country.
And so you're still in your 20s when you've determined that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We needed to stay somewhere first world with access to a hospital because I have to have regular MRIs and CAT scans. And
right. And you can't do that.
Therapy.
If you're out in the middle.
And I take 25 pills a day. I mean, just, you know, there's a lot that,
Yeah. You
know, you just have to be sensible about. And so for a while we were kind of lost because we were so focused on that.
Right.
And then, well, what are we going to do now kind of thing? And my husband had gotten work here in Grand Rapids, and so we were kind of settled. It's like we had a place to live. We're kind of settled and had my doctors and everything. And then I got pregnant with my other daughter, Connor, and got sicker. And again, almost died. And
oh, jeez.
Coming out of that, I also had blood clots in my lungs and, you know, I mean, a whole lungs had collapsed at the end.
Oh,
and both my daughters were emergency C-sections. Carol was taken almost 2 months early. I was in the hospital for a month and then, and out of home for 2 months because when they let me go from the hospital, we had to move in with my parents because I had, you know, major wounds and drains. I had pancreatitis and gallbladder surgery,
oh my
you know,
goodness.
3 days after they did the emergency C-section, and my lungs had collapsed, and, you know, so
oh my goodness.
I needed care. So it was another month after that before we actually went home.
Oh, my goodness.
And then with Connor, they're just under 3 years apart. With Connor, they did the emergency C-section, and then they were shoving nitroglycerin underneath my tongue. They thought they were going to lose me on the table kind of thing. So it was a very, you know, lots of drama. And then I went home and at first it looked like I was going to be okay. And then I started having all these other symptoms just like dropping and having seizures. And at that's around that time is when they sent me to U, eventually to condense greatly, went to U of M in Ann Arbor. And that's when they said a variant of MS. And we say that because it doesn't present as typically as MS. They don't know what else to call it because it has so many things in common. It's, a neurological thing. And there's so many other things, that come into play. I actually have like 4 different autoimmune diseases that they've diagnosed. And so it all sort of falls, that's the umbrella that's easiest to sort of lump it under.
Kind of explain it.
Right. Yeah. But after Connor was born that year after, the reason that I'm talking about it, because that's when I went back to quilting because I lost speech. I lost a lot of cognitive function. I couldn't process when someone would speak to me. I would catch some of it, but I couldn't really. And when I would talk, what someone would hear would not be what I thought I was saying. It just, everything was, you know.
So you went from being this accelerated student.
Uh-huh. Brilliant. And multiple languages.
Highly accomplished in the academic realm. And then to have to.
Right.
Struggle to speak again.
Right. I mean, lost mobility.
How old were you when you were going through
blind?
This?
I was in my 20s still.
Oh my goodness.
So it was a complete loss of identity. Yeah. You know, just and utterly and, you know,
and
completely.
Your new mom too on top of that.
Yeah.
Your children.
Yeah,
both
two
your
little
kids
ones.
Were
yeah.
And they're 3 years apart.
Right. So at that point I had, I called her Grandma Baldwin, Thelma Baldwin. She was a grandma of the heart. You know, not of blood, you know, and really took me under wing. And she had had a history, I might have mentioned this 10 years ago when we did the interview, but she had had a history of working with vets returning from World War II and using art therapy to help them, especially ones that had traumatic injuries and amputations and head injuries, all this kind of stuff. So she really took me under her wing, and she was an incredible artist. She did everything too. She painted and she wove and she, you know, made quilts and she made clothes and, you know, everything. And she said, well, you know, what are you interested in? What do you do? And I said, well, I know a bit. And she said, okay, fabric. You're less likely to hurt yourself if you're fabric. So,
right.
Got me started quilting again, and it was a way of therapy. It was a way to work on just the manual movements, you know, getting control of arms and legs and, you know, hand-eye coordination again. And it gave me a way to communicate. So initially, that's what it was to me. It was a way to communicate because I could put into that all the love I was feeling, the frustration I was feeling, the grief I was feeling. And I remember very distinctly there was one moment where I was working on a binding on a quilt and I was just, you know, very, very calm and then all of a sudden, like, there's tears, you know, dropping. And it was like all the grief and everything of everything just sort of hit. And I sort of wrapped up in the quilt. And it felt like a hug. And I felt like my grandmother had passed away by this point.
Yeah.
I felt like my grandmothers and great-grandmothers and all that around me. And I could feel the handwork they had done.
Right.
And all the many times they had put their frustrations and joys and fears and sorrows into the handwork that they were doing. And it felt like such a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it also felt very empowering and comforting.
Sure.
And I think that was kind of a turning point for me, sort of mentally, spiritually, emotionally, you know, kind of thing. From then on, was obsessed. There's just no word for it.
Yeah.
And 3 years later, I began showing my work publicly as a, initially I was billed as an Irish-American fiber artist.
Really?
Because I was showing work that was, my mother's family's from County Tipperary in Ireland, and I was doing the Celtic quilts.
Okay.
And again, it was that looking for connection. Because we grew up and traveled all over the place, we have a wonderful extended family in New York and Pennsylvania that I love very deeply. But we were in and out of their lives so much that it was always like, we're part of it, but not really part.
Right.
And they wouldn't say that, but that's what it felt like. To us, because it's like we would be gone for these huge gaps and we'd come back and everybody's talking about, well, this and this and this, and we had no clue,
right,
you know, what they were talking about.
Right.
And so there was a searching for belonging, a searching for, you know, you don't feel really American because you're not, you know, you miss so much of the popular culture and whatnot as a kid, but you're not from Africa. You're obviously not from Africa. You're not from Europe. You're not from, you know, where, and people say, where are you from? Right. You know, I didn't know. Yeah. So that was one of my interests in researching initially the Celtic stuff. Part of that was that searching for the connections. And at that point, the work that was being done in fiber with Celtic work was Philomena Durkin. It was all hand. Mm-hmm. And I went through this, well, I want to do that, but I can't do that because I don't have the, I mean, I had gotten better. Right. I made progress, but I don't have the, and Grandma Baldwin is like, well, figure it out. I mean, she was kind of a little bit of tough love. She's like, figure it out. I'm like, well, okay. She said, don't feel sorry for yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Why can't you? I said, well, you can't do it by machine. Everybody says, and she's like, well, why not? Well, everybody says, why not? I said, okay. So I figured out how to do it by machine. And that was the breakthrough, because that's what created the technique that eventually led to the books and the teaching and the traveling nationally right. and all that kind of stuff. So it's always interesting that in my life it's been a consistent pattern of things that look really horrible at the time. And I've only mentioned a few. I could get, there's a lot of examples that we'll just, in the interest of time, we'll not go there. But a lot of really horrible things that led to really wonderful things.
Right.
And it wasn't immediate, and it doesn't diminish the pain or the grief or, right. of the bad things.
Sure.
And I don't want to sound all Pollyanna about it, because I get really frustrated when people do that. Well, everything's going to, you know, everything's going to be fine and whatnot. Because it's just like, okay, how do you know that? That seems so disrespectful of the pain.
Right. And you have to respect the pain and give
you
it to
you.
You have
to, yeah. And it's, and
acknowledge
my,
it for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And my thing is I need a witness. I need to be able to say, okay, this is where I'm at.
Right.
It's horrible and painful, but this is where I'm at. And as soon as I can say that and have somebody see that with me, then I can shift gears and say, okay, so what are we going to do about it?
Right. But you need them to at least acknowledge.
Yeah. That. Need to acknowledge it.
Right.
You know, because if you don't acknowledge it, it just eats away at you. It becomes bigger and bigger.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The fear and the, you know. But if you can get it out, okay. And usually for me, it also comes out my artwork. But if you can get it out, then it can, you can move into the, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to try this. And if it doesn't work, that's okay, because we can try something else. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't work, that's okay, because we'll try something else.
Just keep trying.
And just keep trying till you hit on something that does work. And so all of the, you know, the breakthroughs or successes or, you know, the things that I'm known for, they've all come out of really difficult things.
It's just amazing. It's really remarkable, because when you look at some of the techniques, because now it's pretty common to hear people say, oh, I used interfacing or freezer paper and their machine quilting stuff that used to be hand done. Mm-hmm. But you were the first to start doing that. And it's, I don't think people realize, because in your books, you don't really dwell on like where this came from so much.
Right.
Like
the
awful things you had to go through.
Right.
So how do people react when they find out that, when they meet you, and they might see you walking with a cane now, and then they hear, oh, she has MS, and then they look at your work, and they're like, wait a minute. Because we're sitting next to, I mean, you have a bunch of fabric books behind you, you have these dolls, fabric dolls, a bunch of quilts on the table here. This does not look like, there's no evidence anywhere in this that you have any kind of, I'm not saying I don't believe you,
sure.
I know it's true.
I know.
But I
yeah.
mean, it really is amazing, because, I mean, this would be amazing without hearing that part of the story. And to have, I mean, how do people react when they see you walk into a room to teach a workshop and realize, like, oh, she has something, you know, a disability that she's overcoming here. I mean, how do people respond?
Well, I get kind of funny about it. I'm going to back up for just a second. I want to say, when I started doing the machine work and machine applique, I had heard of Harriet Hargrave. I'd never met her or seen her, but she is kind of
the pioneer,
godmother of machine quilting. Not that she was the first either, but she's the one that really wrote the seminal book that was the breakthrough book that opened it up and made room for the rest of us to then go in and develop our own twists on things. And so I do want to give a shout out to her. She's still teaching. She's on the circuit. You know, she's wonderful. I don't want to make it sound like she's so old or anything. She's not.
Right. No. but she was
a pioneer. Yeah. And I did develop brand new techniques, but it was that helped develop my own career. But I was definitely encouraged and influenced by the fact that somebody else had at least thought of this and was doing this.
Right.
In terms of the you know, disability, the physical stuff, it's kind of a catch-22 because on the one hand, I have lived with severe chronic pain for over 30 years. So I have a lot of practice in covering it up and in masking when I can't really see who I'm looking at or I can't, or I don't know exactly where I am, or if I see three instead of one, or if
and this happened to you
if
when
I
you're
see
oh like teaching or
fairly constant, you know, or if something goes a little fluey, or if I'm, you know, in you know, just this shy of, you know, of screaming Mimi's of the pain. I'm really good at masking. You have to learn to, you know, if you're not gonna live in that place, you have to learn to sort of distance yourself from it.
Right.
And so I am good at that. And sometimes my husband says I'm too good at it because people don't realize. And then if I get to the point where I ask for help, people or say, no, I can't do that. They don't take it seriously. Don't realize that.
Really needs help. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm real good at bargaining with my body. Okay. We're going to go and we're going to do this. And then when we get home, you can collapse for the next 3 days, which is usually what happens.
Oh, okay.
Or, you know, bargain, you know, and I have ongoing physical therapy and I'm in vestibular therapy as well. And we do exercise. My husband and my daughter do exercises with me virtually every day that we learn from my therapist to help keep me limber. I have a wheelchair that I use, and it's bright red, and I have bright red shoes to match because if you have to have one, it might as well be a fashion accessory.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, we make accommodations what we can, but for the most part, you know, I try to make it a non-issue. And for years, I didn't talk about it or didn't talk about it much. But then I realized that just in the occasions in class when I did say something or somebody asked me about something or somebody noticed something, that I learned that maybe it was important to talk about it because almost everybody that, I mean, any group that I am in, whether I'm teaching or facilitating the group or, you know, as a guest speaker or just, you know, hanging out with friends, almost every group I'm in, there's, you know, a good chunk of those people who are either dealing with some sort of chronic thing themselves or are close to somebody who's dealing with it or have been through some sort of traumatic either event or illness or accident or something that forced them to change, that lose their identity and have to start over.
Yeah.
And that these things are fairly universal. You know, any one particular individual's life might seem, you know, very strange that any of this would all happen to one person. But those kinds of things are almost archetypal that you see them over and over again. And I discovered that when I did talk about them, that it created a very powerful connection. And it seemed to be encouraging to people to realize that, okay, you don't have to, just because that's where you are doesn't mean that's where you have to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a book several years ago. It's When Walls Become Doorways. And I'll have to look up the author for you later because it was the most profound book for me because it was about people who had been through an illness or a physical accident or something and were somehow impaired afterwards. And I think it even covered mental health issues as well as part of that debilitation, you know, kind of a thing.
Right.
And in the book, though, it's filled with stories that show how that's not an ending point. It's just information.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a death sentence. It's not an end point. It's not a, you know, a sentence or...
We are
stuck there. It's not the end of
the story.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Thank you. It's not the end of the story. And it shows how from example after example how people learned to be creative in different ways, through different things. And the extreme examples are the people that learn how to still create art using the brain waves and modern technology and all this stuff who are paraplegics. And, you know, so that's kind of the extreme, you know, end of it. But I love that book, and that's been extremely encouraging to me and powerful for me. And so I guess in that way I understand. Sometimes I don't understand when people say, well, this, you know, it's so encouraging me to hear your story, and I think of you, and I tell you, my friends, and there's times that I just don't get it.
Well,
because I think of myself, and I think, oh, man, you know, I and you don't want to look at me. I'm such a mess. And yet when I think about how the impact of this book has had on me, then I kind of do get it, because right. it helps to know that there's other people who are struggling and there's other people who are having success, who are getting through it.
Right.
That, you know, it's not like you have to reinvent the wheel. That right. there's a template out there.
Right.
And that you can learn to be resilient, even if you don't feel like you're particularly resilient at the beginning. You can learn to be resilient. Right. It's a skill that you can develop.
Sure.
And learn that it's sort of how to reframe a situation and say, okay, realistically, I can't do this. And I get real frustrated sometimes when I watch I'm addicted to some of the reality TV shows. Guilty Secret, okay? You know, like, I love So You Think You Can Dance, probably because I can't move
yeah,
very
I
well.
Dance very
and
well
so
either.
I admire anybody who can, yeah. So, but sometimes you hear them say, well, you know, if you just have a dream, you can do it. And if you work hard, you can do it. And there's a part of me that agrees with the ethic, the work ethic part of it.
Right,
there's part of me that gets
right.
really frustrated because it's like, no, no, no. You're setting people up to get frustrated because then they feel like it's a failure on their part.
Yeah.
When really you have to hold things lightly. Have a goal, you know, work your little heart out for it. But then hold it lightly enough that if something happens and that door is closed to you, you can reach for something else
right,
and
right.
not just, you know,
well,
get stuck there in misery.
Sometimes people fixate on that one thing. Maybe it's whether it's going on the show You Think You Can Dance and they think, mm-hmm. I'm going to be a dancer and that's really what I'm going to do. Or I'm going to be a singer and I'm going to go on American Idol.
Yeah.
For me, those two doors are closed.
Yeah. Well, and likewise.
I cannot sing. In fact, people probably pay me to step off the stage as opposed to continuing singing.
I'm with you.
And it's one of those things where if I could sing, it'd be the most amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love that, to have that skill.
Yeah.
But since I know that no matter how hard I work, I'm not going to be able to make a platinum record. It's
right.
just not something that... And I think that I see what you're saying, because if you have people that focus exclusively, I want to be the best quilter in the world.
Yeah.
Well, maybe quilting isn't the thing they're supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
So if you hold it lightly and you get blown in another direction
yeah.
toward the thing you're supposed to do,
yeah.
you have to be open to that.
Right. Or maybe they're not meant to make traditional quilts. Or maybe they're not meant to make, you know, something really far out.
Like the Celtic
out. There's,
quilts,
there's different
it could be some
things.
Other kind of...
Now, I can yeah. teach anybody to do the Celtic quilts. I got that.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
My specialty is figuring out easy, accessible ways to do things that look complicated.
Oh,
that's kind of my market.
And that's,
my
and
niche,
everybody wants
you know?
To know how to do that.
So,
you know?
But I've had to learn to do that because of my own physical limitations.
Yeah.
But that opened a door for me. That
right.
created a market. So, you know, it's one of
it
those.
It is the wildest thing. Because when you think about, like, during your hardest times when you're recovering, and, like,
mm-hmm.
some of you're trying to get stage
yeah.
back and all that, you probably never imagined that that process was going to create a career for you.
Oh, yeah. I remember on one of my first excursions out of the house after it extended, this is after Connor was born, gone through the worst of it. One of my early excursions out of the house, I was at a fabric store and I had picked some fabric and I'd only been there for like 15, 20 minutes and I was just utterly pooped. You know, it was okay. I'm cooked. And I went to pay for the fabric. I'm staying at the register and I had my checkbook out and they told me, and I couldn't remember how to fill out the check.
Oh my goodness.
I couldn't remember how to write the check.
Were
I couldn't remember
else?
My name. Yes, I have not been legal to drive in over 20 years. So,
okay.
Fortunately,
so
my husband was there. But he was trying to be respectful and give me space and not to worry, you know.
Thing. Yeah.
And I just froze. I could not figure out how to sign my name. I couldn't figure out how to fill
oh
out the
goodness.
Check. It just, you know, just, it was a brain fart is what I call him.
Yeah.
Just kind of brain fart. And so finally I just turned to him and I must've looked truly pathetic because he stepped up right
and
away and took it over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did the people notice
yeah.
at the registry?
Oh yeah. They thought I was nuts, you know, but they can't tell just looking.
Like they don't know what's going
somebody.
On.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so
you
many
know.
Other things that sometimes cause people and
right.
usually sometimes it's self-inflicted abusive types of
exactly.
behavior. So you have
you
no
don't,
idea
you
looking
don't
at
know.
A person
yeah.
what would be going on.
One of the reasons I used to travel and teach nationally and literally all over the country from, you know, Atlantic City to San Diego, New Jersey to California and, you know, up in the Dakotas down to Texas and, you know, everything in between. And part of me loved that because it was fun to meet people who are excited and share your excitement and about
sure.
what you're doing. But it was also very physically demanding. And for several years, my doctor was saying it was, you know, you got to not do this. This is dangerous for you. And finally, at the at in the last year or so that I was doing it, I had several instances where my vision just sort of fuzzed out, and I would be on the edge of seizure at O'Hare. And on the one particular, they changed. It was winter.
So you're at the airport.
And I'm at O'Hare.
By yourself?
They changed, by myself. They changed the gate 3 times. I couldn't read any of the signs. I'm on the edge of the seizure. I sound slurring my words. I look drunk. So I'm trying to ask for help, and people are like blowing me off because I look drunk.
Oh, no.
And it's a miracle I got home.
So how did you?
There's some great, I don't remember. I, to this
day. Did you go to the hospital or something?
No, I got on the plane, and I think it was just a lot of grace going on that it was the right plane. But that was one, and several similar kinds of things. That was the worst, that finally we're like, okay, we got to stop. And it was just about, it was the same time that I had done a couple of freelance classes for Brian at Lakeshore Sewing, and he said, you know, we were just kind of talking. He said, how you doing? I said, actually, I'm a little discouraged right now. I said, it's gotten really hard for me to travel. My kids are almost grown up, but they really want me there, and I know that they're going to be gone soon, you know, going on having their own lives, and I want that for them, but I want to spend time with them while I can.
Right.
And I just don't know what we're going to do because, you know, financially I need to be able to work and I'm just not sure how this is all going to work out. And he said, well, what would it take you to be full-time at Lakeshore? And that's how that opened up. So now
and
I've
been there how long
full-time
now?
Creative director at Lakeshore. He hired me at the end of 2006, I believe.
Okay.
And so that has opened up a lot of new doors and it's meant that I don't have to travel. I still teach retreats, 2 or 3 times a year. I either co-host or teach a retreat. I do the storytelling and fabric retreats. And those are good for me because we go and we're in one place.
Right.
And it's a familiar place and it, you know, I kind of know
so
where
you
everything
travel
is.
With, and you go with people you
I
know,
I travel with
too.
People I know.
Right.
And I try to do things that are within driving distance. Because another thing when I used to fly is I used to travel with up to 60 to 80 quilts with me. Most of them small, but I used to big golf bag. You know, golf bags. And you can't do that now between security and the cost for all that baggage
right,
and whatnot.
Right.
So I retired from that at a good time.
Yeah, you should.
But now somebody has to go with me,
right.
You know, when I do things. But it's working out.
Yeah,
and
you're still finding ways to stay.
And I'm full-time at Lakeshore, but I'm able to do most of my work from home, which means if I have to be in my jammies with my laptop in my bed, that's fine.
Right.
I can get the work done.
I and
get
that's
the
all
work
they
done.
Care about. Right.
And and it works out well for Ryan because I bring a lot of expertise in areas that are different from him, and I've learned a lot from working with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been a good thing. But again, it wouldn't have happened if the bad hadn't gone through a patch that was bad enough that I had to change.
O'Hare.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's scary experience.
Yeah. And I have seizures regularly, but this was. It was a bad
How
thing.
Regularly? I mean, how?
Daily.
Really?
Yeah. And they vary because the seizure can be, and I'm on medication for the seizures now that actually is really, I shouldn't say daily because it's actually much better than it used to be. So it's not daily anymore. And they range from just little blips, you know, like little brain farts to being, you know, unconscious for, you know, anywhere from 15 to 40 minutes.
Wow.
To jerking kind of stuff. Well,
can you predict it a little bit?
Sometimes I can feel it's coming. If I'm paying attention, I can feel it's, you know, coming and get to a safe place. But, you know, I think there's always a little grace going on. It usually will happen after I've taught or something, after I've been somewhere. Then I go home and
like
collapse. You get to a safe place. You know, your body kind of knows you get to a safe place.
And
usually that's
then,
what happens.
Wow.
But since we've, you know, medications are a constant reevaluation. You have
right.
to keep
you
tinkering with them. But that has really made a huge difference in that.
Yeah.
Because I used to have the jerking, just jerking, like hours at a time at night, incredibly painful.
Oh, jeez.
And so that's, you know, and that's still, if I do a long day, that's, you know, so I just plan, okay? If I go, I try not to go out more than like twice a week in a week and do my things at home, but
mm-hmm.
we can work. We can make it work.
And you have. And
so.
Yeah. And it really is inspiring, though, what has come out of this, because there are people that have challenges and they
mm-hmm.
don't make such beauty out of it. And
yeah.
that is one of the things that's been just so amazing about. You know, every time I check, because I checked in with you over. I know
yeah.
the first interview we did was I wrote about when your first book came
uh-huh.
out for the newspaper. At that point, I didn't have a craft column.
Right.
There wasn't really a spot in the paper.
Right.
Really, because it didn't quite fit with books, because it
yeah.
was different than regular
yeah.
books.
Yeah, because it was a book coming out, but it
but
wasn't.
But it was more
yeah.
than that. It was more
mm-hmm.
than a book coming out.
Right.
And there's more of a story there. So we still got it in the paper, but it's just been so fun to see kind of what you've been up to since then.
Okay.
And looking back, what do you think the greatest lesson that you've learned through all of this? Because it's, I mean, I'm sure you've learned many things. Mm-hmm. You've developed great techniques to get around your challenges. But what, I mean, if you had to like sum this up, and what has been the greatest lesson that you've learned?
Well, the greatest lesson that I'm still working on learning and remember sometimes better than others is not to be afraid. And this is what I have told my daughters, that I said, if there's one thing I want you to take away from growing up watching this and being part of this, is not to be afraid of whatever happens to you, because bad things are going to happen. You know, it's just part of life,
right,
you know,
right.
It doesn't, you can do everything perfect and painful things are going to happen. Just, you know, it's just part of life. It's unavoidable. And worse things are going to happen to some people than others, but that, I'm not big into comparing one person's pain to another, because each person's pain is individual.
Right.
And I don't think you could say, well, hers is worse than mine, or is worse than, you know, I think that's irrelevant.
Right.
The point is, we all are going to face adverse circumstances.
Sure.
And if you go into it knowing that, and you go into it knowing that, okay, no matter how hard it is, or how much it hurts, or how scared I am by it, in my response, and I always teach, I've tried to taught them, there's, you know, there's your response, and in your response mode, you're allowed to fall apart. Okay, you can get freaked out, and you can do the primal scream, and you can cry, and you can do whatever you need to do in that response time. But then the response time gets over, and then after the response, or the, after the reaction, I'm sorry, that's the reaction time.
Okay, the reaction time.
Right. I'm sorry, I used the wrong word there. In your reaction time, you can fall apart and be a mess, and you know, whine and all that. As long as then you move into the response, and in the response time, that's when you get the confidence that helps you not be afraid, because you learn that whatever happens, there's always a way to deal with it.
Right.
There's always a way. And it might take a few tries. You might have to try and try and try. You might have to, you know, it might not click right away, but there's always a way. And if you can go in through life, and there will always be grace. There will always be grace from people around you. There will always be that spiritual support around you. You are not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that assurance, then you don't have to be afraid.
Right. And that does take a lot of the pressure off, because I think fear is such a crippling thing.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what you're facing, you know, it's,
definitely.
It stops people.
Yeah.
You know.
And it can prevent you from growing. It can prevent you from even seeing the possibilities.
Right.
And it makes everything that does happen 10 times worse, because you're reacting not to what actually happening. You're reacting to the emotional truth of what you're feeling,
right,
which might be totally out of proportion of what actually happened.
Where do you think you get this self-awareness from? Because not everybody has that. I mean, there are people that have gone through some stuff. I mean, everybody's gone through something, you know, but sometimes people don't develop that sense of self-awareness. Because just in what you're saying, you've not only gone through this, but you're able to like analyze and process. And do you think that's just a throwback to the student you were that was so like meticulous about the work you did?
I think it's a multi-causal thing. I think a lot of it is from my parents, both my mom and my dad, because they, I learned a lot by example from them, and they were very young when they had me. So they had to do some, there were some parts where we all grew up together, you know, kind of thing, you know, and there's times when, you know, maybe things weren't done the best way, and later on they learned and we talked about it. But they set a very good example of talking it out and saying, this is what's going on, this is what I'm feeling, this is how we're dealing. So that was very empowering, in just having that example of, it's okay to talk about all this stuff.
Right.
And not only is it okay, but it's expected.
Right.
And it's important. And the fact that for such a big chunk of my childhood, we didn't have TV, and we didn't have, no, we have a TV. Okay. You know, I'm not saying no TV, but we didn't have a TV. And when we did have a TV, it was very controlled.
Right.
How much time we spent for it. So we spent a lot of time together as a family, and a lot of time talking and interacting with each other. And then, so I was, that groundwork was already laid. And then of course I have the training and stuff on top of it, but you know, it was kind of already nurtured you know, by example.
That there's going to be some discussion about events that go on.
Yeah, you know, and how you're feeling and how responding to it, and on many different levels, you know, spiritually and emotionally and psychologically. And my parents are very, you know, aware of all those things, and very compassionate people. They set a really powerful example of compassion and acceptance to the people around you, and respect, not just acceptance, but respect for people that are different. And while we were growing up, we had people of, you know, all different, you know, backgrounds and ethnicities and belief systems and, you know, social status, all different, arranged through our home and as part of our lives. And it was all good. It was all welcoming. It was right. all part of, and again, that was very, very powerful. And then, and being able to talk about the differences. Okay, well, why does he think this and he think this? And realizing that the more differences you see, at first, all you see is the differences.
Right.
It's that culture shock.
Sure.
Okay, first, all you see is the differences. But then if you stick with it, then you begin to see the universe, the universality of experience. And you realize that underneath all these trappings that we're all dealing with similar things.
Right.
And so, again, I think that helped with the being able, comfortable talking about it, and the, and then I'm just kind of anal that way too. You know? So, you know,
yeah.
I have to tease it out and analyze
yeah.
it. And,
well,
you know.
And I think though it does, everyone deals with the challenges in our lives a different way. But I think one of the things that's really wonderful too is that you've been able to help yourself, but then take that into the classroom and help the people that come to you. And you never know. I know I've taught classes where, you know, you don't know what people are bringing into
right.
the classroom.
And you don't know what they're taking away either.
You have no idea what they're taking away. And so. In some respects, I almost want to, like, do post, you know, interviews at the end, be like, okay, so how did that go for you?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you
yeah.
can learn so much
yeah.
from your students' reactions. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think has got to be so powerful for the students is the give. You're telling them it's okay to, like, just whatever you're dealing with in your life, it's okay to kind of, like, try to kind of get through that a little bit and create something.
Yeah.
Because some people just wall that off and they stop creating, or they think they can't. And and that's gotta be, I mean, when you see that light bulb go off for a student, what is that like for you?
Oh, that's the most amazing thing. That's what makes it worthwhile, because there's times when the teaching and the preparation for it is so physically demanding and it's so exhausting that I think, why am I doing this? And does this really make a difference to anybody? Is it worth it? You know, I'm like killing myself. And it sounds all over dramatic, but there's times when that's the emotional truth
right,
of it.
Right.
And some days, you know, every group is different. Some days you don't get much back. And other days, you know, just even one or two people come up afterwards and they say something and you realize that you were able to be, you know, a little instrument of grace in their lives in that moment. Cause you were able to say something they needed to hear or help them open a door that they were ready to open. You know, you're just creating a safe space for them to do it.
Right.
I think a lot of what I do is I'm trying to create a safe space for that person to create from their heart. It's not about teaching them to do what I do or what somebody else does.
Right.
It's I'm really interested in helping them bring out what's inside and helping them create a space and develop the skill set to do that. And that's like the most rewarding thing in the world. And it's kind of like that pay it forward thing too.
Oh yeah.
Because in my life, all the difficult things that have happened and all the, you know, the hardships at every point, there's also been people around when I needed them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been so many people who have helped, not just me, but my family, you know, have helped us in some ways little, in some ways big, in some ways they didn't even know they were doing it. And in other, you know, other times it was very deliberate that I always feel like, okay, if I can do that for somebody else, what Grandma Baldwin did for me or what somebody else did for me, then, you know, that's worth it.
Yeah, and it is kind of contributing to keep that cycle going, so that people get help when they need it.
Yeah, because we're like all in this together, which I now sound all, you know, sentimental and mushy, but I'm kind of that way.
Yeah, when I think one of the things too that I know, just I know for me, I do a lot of, you know, community stuff where I'm doing a lot of free workshops, a lot of things, and I know this discussion comes up for a lot of people who make things with their hands. You know, how do we put a value on this?
Yeah.
Because a lot of that, what you get paid, I can't say amount of dollar amount that someone could pay me, because there is no dollar amount that someone could pay me that would replicate that feeling I get when I see someone kind of like, it's almost like they transform in the class where they, and it's not me doing anything. It's just,
well, you're coming up and creating the space environment,
or you might ask a question or give a prompt or,
but
it's the person comes in with all the ingredients.
Right.
Like, you just help.
Yeah, they still have to do the work.
Yeah. And that, when you see somebody light up and they're maybe staying after class and they came in looking kind of like, you know, arms crossed. Yes, this is for me.
I've actually seen that in class.
She said, I'm here because I broke my, she had a foot injury. She said, I'd rather be running right now. And I was just like, as a runner, I understand the frustration if you can't run. And I thought, well, this is going to, I mean, how is this going to go? And when she stayed after class, I'm so thankful. I mean, there's no amount of money that could. So I don't know if you had advice for people, and this is kind of more on the business side of of just, you know, those who work with their hands and want to teach others. How did you, when you you figured out how to do all these things in a way that, you know, you could still be creative and all these shortcuts, and they're so valuable, but how do you, how did you then figure out how to put a price on that? So when you're going to a workshop or you're trying to sell your book, I mean, how did you put a monetary value on that?
Well, some of those decisions are made for you. It's like, if with the books, I, Martingale & Company was my publisher. So they're the ones that set the number of pages, and I always run 20 pages over. No matter how many pages they give me, I'm always 20 pages over that have to be cut at the end, you know. It's just it's the way it is. And then they set the pricing and, you know, all that. So, and they give you your little percentage, which is very small. Like, on a $25 book, you know, an author may get, you know, less than a dollar.
Which you think is just...
And I've talked to other authors, and some of them are getting less than 50 cents, you know, on a $25 book. So it really...
Looking back, was it worth it for you to do that?
Yes, it was. Now, in terms of the actual making the money, if you figured it out a per hourly, you know, an hourly rate, if the book is just going to do one run, you're not making, you know, you don't figure it out. You get depressed. you're more likely to make your money. Now, the Celtic book, that one went through many, many, many printings. So that
in the end,
it worked out. And it's actually just been re-released as an ebook now. You can get it for half the price. You can get it, download it, and it's the full book, patterns and everything, and you can print it off or keep it on your computer, which is kind of funny. But it's the... If you're looking at it as a making a living thing, you're more likely to make your money on the teaching circuit.
Right, and the book gives you some kind of
It gives you credibility.
Credibility.
People know that that's it's sort of an objective thing that this person has been vetted and they know what they're talking about. And then teaching, you know, the teaching, selling the book and teaching, that's where you're going to get your, that's where it's more likely to be monetarily of value. Local classes have always been a big thing for me. Both, I like to teach locally as well as on the road. One of the things I particularly like about teaching locally is I develop relationships.
With the people
I have in classes, and I care about them, and they care about my family, and it's, you know, we may not see each other very often, but the relationship is real and the connection is real, and I really like that, being able to, you know, develop that over time as opposed to, you know, when you go travel somewhere to teach, you know, you may or may not see those people again.
Exactly.
So it's a different dynamic. But I also had a history of teaching, because when we were in Africa, I started teaching at 13, you know, or 12, I think. I was writing lesson plans in French and teaching a group of girls. And so I was familiar with that. And by this point, I started teaching in 97. I started teaching at Grand Quilt. You know, teaching. And so I'd had, you know, several decades worth of experience in teaching and presenting in different kinds of venues and developing lesson plans and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Right. So I was familiar with that kind
of stuff. How soon after you started doing, you got back into quilting, that was, what year was that when you got back into it?
I really got back into Whole Hog in 92.
Okay.
And then started showing professionally in 95.
Okay.
And started teaching in 97. And my first book came out, I got my book contracts, I got in 99. First book came out in 2000.
Okay.
And then I had three books come out within like 3 or 4 years. They actually came out too fast. It would have been better to space them better, but I didn't have control. over that.
And when you have that opportunity there, it's hard
I
to
know,
say no.
Especially, you know, you're like, yes, ma'am, okay, jump how high? What do you want me to do, you know?
Yeah, and then, yeah, so. You don't really think so much about, okay, this is going to be like a college experience.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, we need to spread this out more.
But they're done now. They're done now.
So
what's next for you? What do you want to do next?
I don't know. I also, the last few years have been doing private creativity coaching. And I really love that because it's an opportunity to work one-on-one and really, you know, see somebody develop. I work with just a few clients just because of the time factor.
Right, right.
They come to me.
Right, at your house or at the store?
Mm-hmm. Generally here. Oh, okay. Yeah. And I love doing the retreats. I love being at Lakeshore. There's some things I love more than others. You know, be frank. Any job,
is
going to have its challenges. I feel like there's the freedom there, and working with Brian as the owner that we can sort of adjust as things go. And my job changes every year in terms of what's most needed for the whole company and where the holes are, where we want to put the emphasis And so I feel like there's a lot of flexibility there that I'm really grateful for.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how long, we'll be there. I don't know. And people often, are you going to do another book? And I don't know. I might. I think there's probably some more books in there. But I don't see myself touring again right now physically. That's just not on the table.
Well, they do blog tours now, so you don't even have
to do it. So that might be a game changer because that's been a factor. I thought, there's no point in doing another quilt book because I really can't go on the road like that. Again,
I would just do a blog tour.
Physically not possible anymore. So I don't know. We'll see. I have learned never to say never.
Yeah. Things come. You maintain your connection with the local because you're also the mentor for the art quilting group. Two groups here in Western Michigan.
Yeah, the Lakeshore Fiber Artists. Two groups. The first group is has been going longer because we started that one first, and that one started in 2007, I think. And then the other one started, I think, the end of 2008, mm-hmm. I think, somewhere right in there. But they're full groups. I mean, we don't publish them. We don't publicize them very often because usually we have waiting lists.
Right.
And
so should I not publicize that?
No, it's okay.
As well known as you are, they may not be able to fly in.
There you go.
But here in West Michigan, as far as the column's concerned, should I not mention the group?
No, that's okay. Because sometimes
them?
We do have openings.
Okay.
I just, if they try to get in, I don't want anyone to feel bad because we're not. It's not
like
a club that we're
thing.
Not letting
it's
them
just,
in. It's you, just,
well, I was
you
in,
know, there's only so many chairs.
Yeah, there were no empty chairs.
And we had 10 people who were not there.
Yeah, I can't even
because
believe
of,
that.
Because, you know, being out of town and things. So it's, you know, cozy.
That's got to make you feel pretty good, though, to have
well,
this
it's exciting.
Waiting list for people.
It's exciting to see that the momentum has kept up. Because
right.
I kind of wondered at the beginning, well, is this just going to run its course? And people go, it's a really cohesive group. And it's what's really wonderful now is that, especially in the NAP group, that we have a number of the members who've been there since the beginning, and many of them who've taken classes for me for over 10 years now, really branching out on their own and taking positions in leadership, such as the show that we just did. I did very little. I organized the food for the opening reception.
Wow.
And they did their, there was a committee, Julia Volk, and had her committee, and they did it. Where the first show that we did, I did everything from all the publicity and writing all the forms to typing up all the artist statements to hanging the show to, you know, so it's really cool to see. They're really taking ownership.
That's great.
And now we have, in fact, the next three meetings in a row, we have members actually doing presenting and so this is
exciting.
Yeah,
that takes the pressure off, and then you can sit back and enjoy the meeting.
Yeah.
You're not planning the meeting, presenting at the meeting.
Yeah.
That's great.
So I still facilitate the meeting,
but
it's amazing. And I get inspired too to see what everybody's doing, and you know, and there's times I say, oh, I want to try that, and how'd you do that? And you know, so it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything I didn't ask you that, I mean, because I know obviously we're trying to condense.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to condense your whole life.
I know.
A short amount of time. But I don't know if there's anything else that you want people to know that I didn't ask you.
Nothing's coming to mind. I guess other than, and then one of the things I would most like to get across, and I'm thinking specifically of the people that I meet who come to our demo days or come to workshops or come to the shows or whatnot, and the ones that say, well, I'm not artistic or I'm not creative or I can't do this or that. And to those people, I just would say, don't do that. Don't give yourself those messages. It's not true. It would be more accurate to say that you are not confident.
Or I just haven't found my thing yet.
Or you haven't found the right thing yet. You know, you haven't, you know, it hasn't clicked yet for you in a right thing. But that doesn't mean you're inherently not creative. And so many people get hung up on some little message that they heard growing up. Maybe some teacher or a friend or a parent made a one-liner or a two-liner comment.
And then they just stop.
That they may or may not have meant as harshly as it was felt.
Right.
You know, again, that whole emotional truth kind of a thing. But that so many people are crippled by things like that. And they're carrying this around and it blocks them off from their own creativity and their own power.
Right.
And I think that would, and I don't have a good solution other than you have to just hang in there and have faith.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of being creative is about having faith, faith that it's worth taking the time. It's worth the investment of any materials that you might use. It's worth the investment of the time that it takes to use, and that it's not dependent on, its value is not dependent on whether or not you can sell it. Because a lot of people say, well, if I can't sell it, then it's not worth my time. Or it's not, they feel like they're being selfish, taking time to do something that they can't sell. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, you do. And it's like, and I really believe that the act of being creative in is in and of itself of value. And it doesn't matter if the end product is, you know, a wonderful, you know, piece of art, or whether it's a, you know, a grocery bag, or, you know, whatever, that the act of being creative is in and of itself a life-affirming act of faith. And now I make my living trying to help people get the tool set to make their work better.
Right.
You know, because it's like a vocabulary. The more techniques you know, the more products you're familiar with, the easier it becomes to concentrate on the message instead of worrying about the how-to and struggling with, you know, the logistics of it.
Right, just learning the basic skills.
Once you get the basic skills, then you can really just let it flow and get out of the way of the process. So, you know, I make my living teaching all these classes and whatnot, but I want people to know that you don't have to have all those classes. You don't have to do cool stuff. We hope you'll take some. We'll be, you know,
you know,
and you don't have to, you know, and you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. I tell my students, finished is more important than perfect.
Yeah.
Because then you go on to the next thing.
Right. You have the guilt and, for the unfinished.
And everything is a learning process. And some things don't need to be finished. You know, sometimes, and you know what? People, I grew up and never had a problem with this. People in West Michigan, a lot of people in West Michigan have a problem with this.
About having it not finished?
Yeah.
Oh, it's like they're embarrassed.
They're embarrassed, and it's a guilt thing. And I don't know, you know, where that all, I don't want to unpack, I don't want to get my feet jammed down my throat trying to unpack that. But a lot of people feel so guilt-ridden about their UFOs.
Yeah.
Unfinished objects they don't allow themselves to go on to new things. And so after I've done a show, especially after I've done a trunk show where I've shown like 60 to 80 pieces in the course of a lecture or a 6-hour class, and somebody makes a comment like that, I say, well, you know what? I have finished hundreds of things, and many of which are in the books or on the websites or whatever. Not all, but many are given away. Hundreds and hundreds of things. But at any given time, I have anywhere between, I used to say 20 and 40. Now it's probably like more like between 30 and 50 UFOs in my UFO pile, you know, and they just look at me like, what, you know, and I said, some of those things are going to get finished. I just don't have the time because it's personal. And so I have to do my professional commitments first before I can do the personal stuff. And sometimes it's because I haven't figured out yet what the technique I need to do what I want to do. And sometimes it's because, you know, I'm designing as I go and I need the inspiration. And sometimes it's because I lost interest. Or sometimes it's because I was learning a technique and I got bored with it. Or I decided I didn't like it. Or, you know, and that's okay.
Well, it is part of the process.
It's served its purpose.
Because not every project is going to get finished.
Right. And it's okay to pass things on. and to somebody else who wants them. And sometimes it's okay to throw it away. And I know and that's like heresy. Oh
yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people like, oh, that's heresy. But you know, if it's blocking your creativity, get on with it.
Right.
You know, liberate yourself and move on and enjoy it. And if you can hang around, you just finish it and be okay with it being imperfect. That's good. I mean, that's, you know, very healthy, but some people can't, they just can't live with the fact that it's not what they think they should be. And to those people, I'd say, get rid of it.
Right.
Get it out of your house. Get rid of it.
So you can move on.
For yourself to move on.
Yeah.
Because it's supposed to be fun.
Right.
You know,
if there's enough psychotic responses yes. to your crafting and your art, then we're all lost.
Yeah. It's supposed to be a source of joy.
Right.
You know,
don't, guilt and shame.
Yeah. And I have to say this very carefully so people don't think I'm swearing on your show. Don't should all over yourself. Do you notice how I said that very slowly and carefully?
Did.
Yes.
Get the pronunciation
because people
right.
do the shoulds. I should do this. I should do that. Don't do that all over yourself.
Yeah.
And let it be a source of joy.
Right.
And that's not to say that there aren't times when it's work. Because, I mean, if you're doing a large project where you've got, you know, 100 of squares to cut, it's work.
Oh, yeah.
But there still should be joy in it, too.
Right.
Yeah.
When I think if people get to the point where they say, you know, and I guess the analogy that I'll use is the running high, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to the point where you don't think about what you're doing, you feel like you could run forever.
Yeah.
I love that, but I get to that point more with the projects I do, and it's like when you decide what you're going to do, and you kind of get lost.
Yeah, you're in the zone. Yeah.
And you just have that, and it's almost like something happens in your brain, like you're thinking of something you haven't done before, and it's like the most amazing experience, and everybody can get to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
You just have to allow yourself. Yep. You know?
And that's actually what this quote was about, this mandala.
Yeah.
It was about being able to get into that to that zone. And for me, it's about feeling, you know, oneness with the universe. I'm sounding all new agey here, oneness with the divine, and feeling the comfort and having that brief escape from pain.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like takes me totally out of my body, out of the whatever, and just the joy of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's all like a transcendent. Almost.
It is. It's very much a transcendent.
I'll forget I have to go to the bathroom, and I've had to have to go to the bathroom for 4 hours, and I haven't eaten any lunch or dinner, and I'm like, I'm so happy, you know, and then you kind of come down when you realize I haven't eaten lunch or dinner, and my bladder's going to explode, you know, but it is just, and I wish that for everyone.
Yes.
It sounds like, I mean, that's what you're pushing for,
definitely.
Is to give everyone that wonderful experience, because it's something that... And it's cheap, too. I mean, you don't have to pay money. I mean, you really could, with a sketchbook, if you draw, or if you knit, or if you, whatever you do, you don't need expensive things
to
be able to get to that point.
Yeah. And I'm on that one. It's like, I love playing with everything. I want to try. I have a new product that's out there. I want to try it. And it's nice that I get paid to do so, you know?
Nice.
That's a nice thing.
Right.
And I like to work with good fabrics and whatnot, but
absolutely.
I also enjoy repurposing and recycling. And there was one thing, it was, you know, the different little mini cultures within families.
Right.
And sometimes, when you marry and you think you're so similar, and later on you find these huge differences. We were kind of talking about this yesterday.
Yeah, which is usually after the marriage.
Yes. But this was about that same time I started quilting again. And was still working on the whole dexterity, you know, thing. And money was tight. You got medical bills up the wazoo, you know.
Oh, yeah, you don't have like, your fabric budget.
Yeah, you don't.
Right.
And so I was looking for things. I was, like, obsessive looking for things to be creative and useful. And my husband had a pile of dress shirts that either they didn't fit or they were too frayed at the cuff or worn out. Or, you know, he's hard on his clothes. And so... Oh, wonderful, all this fabric. And so I cut them into strips and I crocheted, and I made a whole bunch of rugs for the house.
And they must have been beautiful.
So, well, I was, like, thrilled. I was so excited that you know, here it is. I didn't waste anything. You know, you grew up in Africa and see people with nothing.
Right.
I mean, that totally, you learn to make do when you have. You enjoy what you have when you have it. And when you don't have it, you're not afraid of not having it. You just use what you got.
Right.
So... I was using what I had, and I was thrilled. I had these great rugs. I liked the colors, and they looked nice, and I didn't have to buy, you know, spend
anything,
a dime.
Right.
And my in-laws came to visit, and I showed them, because my parents would have been, oh, that's terrific. We're so excited you made something. They're, like, so supportive. And my mother-in-law was so horrified. She was so upset.
Oh, she
was
so upset. She thought this was like a sign of circling the drain or something.
Yeah, she interpreted that as in we were desperately poor and had no money and no, what kind of thing. And she didn't realize that I could have gone out and bought I could afford rugs, you know. It wasn't that desperate.
It
was about the satisfaction and that I could do this without the money.
Right.
And
right.
I can create this by myself. And she totally didn't get it. And I felt so stupid.
Afterwards. It's really funny because, like, even if I had, like, a big estate somewhere mm-hmm. with, like, people to help clean my house and make me food, if I was living like Oprah, I would still be trying to get, I would still pull into Goodwill very enthusiastically.
Oh, yes.
Grab some dress shirts. Mm-hmm. My husband doesn't have a lot of dress shirts.
Yes. So well, my husband doesn't anymore.
Yes, because you cut them all up. But I would still be looking for things to, like, telling people, hey, don't throw out your t-shirts. I weave those into rugs. You know, I mean, I that will never change.
We don't throw out jeans. Yeah. We don't throw out clothes. If, you know, things that are good enough, we donate.
Right.
But things that aren't, we'll cut off the buttons and, you know, it's cut off the big parts. So use the jeans. We love to, you know, recycle jeans and do things with. Yeah.
So it's
and it's not like I don't have access to fabric at Lakeshore Sewing, you know?
We have plenty of examples here of very nice fabric. And it is, I mean, it's thrilling to be able to work with top quality.
It is.
Because if you're going to make, you're going to put your effort into, if you work your way up and you get to be, you want to make a really nice quilt.
Yeah. If you want something to last, then you're better off using something brand new.
Sure, than the old shirt or the old pair of
jeans. For stuff that's just, you're going to love it and use it up and, you know, then it's really sad. I find it very satisfying.
I think it adds a whole other layer for me. Like, I like, oh, wow, I made this fun project, and I am not wasted.
Right.
I love that.
Right. And when we first went to Africa, one of the things that our, as missionaries, my family, the supporting churches did for us is they made, you know, clothes, made dresses and stuff, sundresses and things for us girls, and they used the scraps and they made quilts. And they were really simple quilts, like big squares, big rectangles, you know. The irony, I never said this at the time, but it sort of cracked me up. I thought, do they know where we're going? You know, it's 140 in the sun, you know, in the hot season, and in the winter it gets down to maybe to 90. You know, do they
so
know
where going?
You know, so I did think it was kind of fun. But the funny thing is, though, your blood does thin out. And when the temperature would go down to 90, we would be wrapped up in those quilts and being hot cocoa. Your body adjusts.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
your
blood, I never really, you know, gave any thought to that.
But yeah, but I didn't know that yet. So I thought, well, they know what they're doing, you know. But those quilts gave us so much comfort when we were over in Africa and missing our family and missing anybody who spoke English or, you know, missing seeing anything that looked familiar. And we would look at those quilts and say, oh, this is that dress and this is that dress and this is this shirt and, you know, and play games, see if you could find three colors in a row. You know, just kind of goofy
stuff. Well, it gives you that sense of home wherever
you are. And
the
same thing, you wrap up and you feel the love that somebody took the time to make this for you. And it doesn't matter how simple or utilitarian the item is.
Right.
I think there's something very special about something that was made for an individual by an individual. Mm-hmm. I think there's a power in that can't be duplicated.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate that.
Coming and talking about it.
See, I told you she was going to be inspiring. I don't know. I mean, every time I hear from Beth Ann, I always walk away from the experience feeling inspired and empowered. And here in West Michigan, we love her for that. She is a fantastic woman. And I don't really even think she truly realizes just how talented she is, because she doesn't carry herself as this larger than life person, but she is really, she's fantastic and very accomplished and so generous with her knowledge. She's still teaching here in West Michigan, and we're lucky to have her in town. I'm going to have links on the website to Beth Ann's website, and so you can check that out and sign up for a workshop if you'd like. She's going to be teaching at Fabrications 2010 in Kalamazoo, Michigan. She's going to be presenting fiber collage and three-dimensional embellishment on August 30th and 31st, and then machine quilting and thread painting on September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. So you can see some samples of what she's going to be presenting if you go to her website, which is BethAnnWilliams.com. She also appeared on the HGTV show, so you can find, it was Simply Quilts with Alex Anderson. There's some information about that as well. And then she has three books out, and the first one's Celtic Quilts, A New Look for Ancient Designs. And she also has another book called Color Wash Bargello Quilts, and that was came out in 2001. And then in 2003, A World of Quilts, 10 Projects Using Ethnic Fabric was published. So she's got three books out that are really inspiring as well. So if you want to get more information about all that, I'll have links on the blog. And if you're in town in West Michigan and want to get a chance to meet her or take a class from Beth Ann, definitely check the Lakeshore Sewing class schedule. She teaches regularly, and she always has a list of her local classes and events on her website, so check that out. She is the creative director over there, and definitely draws a lot of people into the shops because she kind of bounces between two locations, and after hearing the show, you can probably understand why she would have a following. Very inspiring lady. Thank you so much, Beth Ann, for your time and for sharing your inspiration. I'd like to thank Jennifer Forrest from ConfidentCrafts.com and Jennifer-Forrest.com for sponsoring this episode. If you visit ConfidentCrafts.com, you're going to find some wet felting with merino wool tops and Nuno felting with fabric and wool top kit projects. And then over on Jennifer-Forrest.com, that's her author site. She's got a book out, Jane Austen's Sewing Box, which explores the craft that Jane Austen's characters and her friends and family did during the 1770s to 1830s. Jennifer Forrest is a trained history teacher and curator, and so that's kind of where this interest in historic crafts all started. She's looking to expand into Victorian and medieval crafting, too. So, very exciting. I have not yet seen her book, Jane Austen's Sewing Box, but I am really intrigued by this. So, nice work, Jennifer. I'm going to have to check that out, and you should too. When you support the sponsors of the show, you're definitely supporting me because they have made a commitment to help keep this show going, and I so appreciate that. So any love we can give back to them helps everybody. And this episode is also sponsored by Mindy over at wishstudio.com. And you need to check out this website. Man, she's got everything going on over there. She runs online classes. You can take a class or teach a class. And, you know, no matter where you live, you can be part of Mindy's virtual studio space. So you need to get over to wishstudio.com and check it out. It's really this interesting, it's online supportive community where you can create, connect, and dive deeper into your creative life. There's a lot of class offerings. She's also offering people an opportunity to start teaching in a virtual studio, which is something that kind of takes the complication out if you're not quite sure how to do that, but you want to get into it. So that's really awesome too. And I'm going to be getting involved with a collaborative jewelry project that Mindy has going on. So I'll be telling you more about that on an upcoming show. So, so visit wishstudio.com and you'll see what I'm talking about. Very, very inspiring place. I'd also like to thank Liberty Worth for being a return sponsor. I so appreciate her support. And you can check out all the cool stuff that she's been working on. Libby Dibby Stuff and Style is all about being inspired by the joy of color and pattern and things that are both vintage and new. Liberty Worth draws inspiration from the things around her, scrap fabrics, creative kiddos, and amazing friends who keep her sense of wonder alive. You can find a few of the things, skirts, hand-stamped charms, baby slings, and bags, at libertyworth.com, but the Etsy store, and you can find that at libertyworth.etsy.com, has all of the one-of-a-kind objects and creations that Liberty makes at home. So if you want to know more about Liberty and her creative life behind the scenes, head over to libbydibbystuff.blogspot.com. So a special thanks to all three of these creative women for supporting Craft Sanity, and I hope that you folks at home will take the time to visit craftsanity.com and click the links that I put on there heading back to the sponsors, because they've been so great about supporting me, and we should all try to support them as well. So thanks again to all you listeners, sponsors, and everybody out there who helps contribute and make this show what it is, because without you listeners, I wouldn't be doing this. If you'd like to be a sponsor of an upcoming show, you can head over to craftsanity.com and click the sponsors link. Send us an email. We'll get back to you with some information. about how you can be part of the next episode of Craft Sanity. You can stick around after the music plays for the after show if you'd like. If not, I'll never know, so don't feel bad if you need to get on to something else. In the meantime, Craft Sanity, my friends, it works for me. Okay, so there's a lot has happened since we last talked. First thing that comes to mind is I had a minor but very painful little bike accident, and I was taking my kids on a bike ride, and it had rained early in the day, and the pavement was dry, but this little bridge that we were going over was not dry, and I was pulling them in a kid carrier in the back behind my bike, and it was kind of my thinking was that, oh, this is some training for, I'd like to do some triathlons this summer, so I thought, oh, you know, I'll just, they really didn't want to go to the Y, and, you know, I thought, well, instead of making them go to the Y, I'll just, you know, pull them in the kid carrier. They can bring stuffed animals and some snacks, and, you know, we're good to go. So we get the grapes, and then we forgot water, and then I ran into the house like 5 or 6 times to get more stuff that I had forgotten. Then people had to go to the bathrooms. They each take turns going to the bathroom, and, you know, about the 5th time I'd gone back into the house, I had set my bike helmet down off to the side because I got their helmets on, and I'm running back and forth. Completely forgot to put my helmet on. So it wasn't until I was sliding into a wooden post head first that I realized, crap, I don't have my helmet on. And it was like slow motion where I'm like, you always wear your helmet. And I'm usually religious about putting my helmet on and making sure other people have their helmet on. And I get upset when I see people riding their bikes without helmets on. So it's just almost astounding to me that I forgot my helmet, but you know how it is. You moms and dads out there, you know, you get sidetracked. You're trying to make sure, you know, all the kids have what they need, and you completely forget, you know, to kind of take care of yourself. And believe me, I don't think I'm going to forget my helmet ever again, because I went sliding, and I knew I was going between two of these like little posts, wooden posts that they put at the end of bridges so people don't try to drive a car over a wooden bridge, because it wouldn't support the weight of a car. So they have these posts there to, you know, prevent large vehicles from going over this little bridge. And I got over the bridge, and we went on this trail, and it was only on our way back that we encountered a problem. I went up the little bridge. There's like a little arch there. I got up of it, and then I was going very slowly because I knew that it was, you know, it was wet, so I was going slow, but when coming down, I put my brakes on, and I think I probably braked too much, and I started to, like, slide. Had no traction whatsoever, and I was riding my mountain bike, and I thought, oh, geez, and I didn't have control of the bike, so I thought, okay, I gotta put this down. And I didn't want to bail, because my kids are in the back, of course, so I tried to do kind of a controlled crash, and was not going very fast when I hit the post, but because I didn't have a helmet on, I mean, I hit my forehead and my, like, over my left eye, and right away I had a goose egg, and I jumped up very quickly, though, because I knew my kids, it was very scary for my children to watch their mother crash headfirst into a post, so I jumped up right away, and it was ridiculous. I used my cell phone, because I had my phone with me, and I took a picture with my phone of my face, because I didn't want to turn around and face my children if I was like gushing or something. So I took a picture, and I could not believe it looked like a cartoon. Like, my head was like completely, my forehead was bulged out, and I had road rash like underneath my left eye, and luckily I did not hurt my eye, and my head hurt just like, it was a really bad headache for a while. And then about a week and a half later, this was about 2 weeks ago, and so now I have a little bit of, my neck hurts a little bit, and my back's a little sore, but I've recovered. And I did not have any concussion, so I'm very, very thankful there, but man, talk about a setback, you know. So, like, it was hard to kind of just focus on things and get, you know, it took me longer to write my column and get all my stuff done because, you know, your head is throbbing, but I don't really take breaks, so I kind of just kept going, and, I just, it's one of those things that you just cannot even believe that has happened. So I'm starting to think that perhaps I should be wearing a helmet all the time, just in case. I mean, after you whack your head that bad, you start to think that crazy stuff like that is actually a great idea. So if I can figure out a way to make a helmet fashionable, you might just see me in an apron and a helmet. My word. So, yeah. So that delayed the podcast and some other things, but yeah, I'm much better now and very mindful of the importance of wearing a helmet. So please, if you don't have a helmet, try to get one. It's just so important to have a helmet on. And I can tell you, as someone who just crashed my head into a post without a helmet on, that you definitely need to wear one. So I'm not going to forget again. And I hope you don't either, because it's just ridiculous. You can prevent a lot of pain by just putting a helmet on. So that's my little public service announcement. Very long-winded. I think they usually public service announcements are, what, like 30 seconds? Yeah, I could never handle a public service announcement job. And I'm working on the quilt for Art Prize, the international art competition that's based here in Grand Rapids. I am working on a hexagon quilt made out of men's ties, and they've been donated by some of the power brokers in town here in West Michigan, and it's really fun to sit there and stitch, transform a tie into a little flower with 7 hexagons. I'm really enjoying that. And I haven't started to panic yet about the time it's going to take to sew all these together, but I like a challenge. And I kind of consider this kind of the marathon of crafting these hexagon quilts. So, yeah, I have a feeling I'm going to be very tired when it comes down to the wire. My hands are probably going to be a little sore, but yeah, we'll get it done. Oh, and on the camping front, my husband and I may have found a camper. The deal has not gone through yet. We're going to have some inspections done to make sure that this camper that we know, I mean, we're not veteran campers. So when we go out, you know, my parents bought a pop-up when I was a kid, and you know, I was not involved at all in the selection of the camper or anything like that. So we're going to have our camper checked out, and hopefully by the next episode, I will be able to report that I'm on the camping scene. So, and now, before I even have a camper, I'm thinking, well, do they have craft night at campgrounds? And can you, like, yeah, get together with other crafty campers? So if you're in a campground with me, you'll probably know, because I'll probably be doing some kind of thing to try to organize a craft night at the campground. So, yeah, hopefully I won't come across as too, you know, abrasive and annoying to people when I'm like, hey, you want to crochet? But yeah, so I have a lot to learn, because it's been a while since I've been camping, and I got to figure out how to craft with strangers at campgrounds without scaring them. So we'll see how that goes. If you have any suggestions for me or anything that you, any story ideas, interview suggestions, I'm going to be ramping up and recording a new batch of interviews real soon. So feel free to send me your ideas. I do appreciate that. One thing I did want to mention is that I'm kind of started the outdoor art market season has started here in Grand Rapids, and it's been really great. I sold quite a few looms this past weekend and really enjoyed meeting some of the people that read my column in the paper. And so that was really fun. And I encourage you, if in your town you have an art market, that's a great place to start selling your work. And I just did a story about with some basic tips for selling at art markets, and I'll put a link to that on the blog in a more prominent spot. So those of you who missed that can check it out, because usually these art markets don't charge much. It's kind of like a farmer's market, and some farmer's markets do let artists in, so that's an option too. But for those of you who want to kind of get out there and meet your public and sell your goods, it's a great way to see what people say about your work. Some of it isn't always great to hear. Like, I had two ladies who spent tons of time at my booth this last weekend, and most everyone was very fabulous to be with and to talk to, but you always have, you know, a couple people that you're just like, where did you even come from? But these two women were talking and asked me all kinds of questions about weaving with fabric strips and cutting up t-shirts, and I did all this, you know, a lot of demonstrating where I'm showing, like, okay, and then you do this, and then you do that, and I didn't really care if they bought a loom or not, but I did start to get annoyed when one of the women turns to the other and says, well, yeah, I think I'm going to go home and make one of these for both of us. And she wasn't talking about making a pot holder. You know, I don't sell pot holders. I sell the looms. She was talking about the loom. She said it, you know, and I'm just like, man, you know, I mean, I don't expect everyone who, you know, comes by my booth to buy a loom, because not everybody has the money to, you know, to just buy whatever they want. You know, I walked through the market and I can't buy everything I want. You know, I get it. And I love to teach people how to weave, so that's totally fine. But it just cracks me up when people say stuff like, oh, well, I'm going to go home and make that. And they ask you a lot of questions about it, and you're just like, oh, my goodness. But, you know, that's part of that's what makes these things so entertaining to be at, too. Because it's kind of like you just don't even need a TV. I mean, you just watch the people, and they watch you, and you just have a fun time. So yeah, make this your summer, 2010, to get out there and get your work in the public if that's a goal of yours. And if it's not, that's totally fine, because the market's not for everyone. So I'm going to get on with my day, and I'm going to let you do the same. And in the meantime, if you need to reach me, jennifer@craftsanity.com. I'd love to hear from you. And yeah, all right. So go forth and be crafty, and I will do the same. I'll be back soon.